Welcome to That Anthro Podcast, the podcast dedicated to anthropology. Together, each week, we will be learning from the experts and researchers that are researching our pasts and today's problems. My name is Gabriella Campbell, and I'll be interviewing a new guest each week to bring to you the latest and greatest in anthropology, based right here out of Santa Barbara. Join me for weekly episodes, whether you're an anthropology buff or looking to learn something new. Welcome to That Anthro Podcast. Hello, listeners. Welcome back to That Anthro Podcast. Today we have Russell Nyland, and I'm so excited. You know, I love when people reach out to me on Instagram or through social media because I think it's super important to ask for what you want and to make opportunities for yourself. So Russell's an example of that. And I'd encourage anyone to, you know, just create your own opportunities. But Russell is not only an anthropologist, but he's applying his anthropology in a really interesting way currently during this pandemic, working at the food banks in Denver and helping people with SNAP benefits and just food insecurity in general. So before we like get into that, I just kind of want to start with like, how did you get interested in anthropology? Was it something you discovered like in college or kind of a passion that started when you were younger?
First off, thank you so much for the space. Really excited to be here and yeah, reaching out to you. I'd listened to your podcasts and just kind of love the conversations that you have with folks. And that would just be kind of interesting to share a little bit about my story or the path that I've taken, because I know I'm not the only one, but it is one that I don't hear about often and one that definitely could have used some support when I was going through it, because first off, going into anthropology, everyone's like, how are you ever going to make money? Or are you sure this is the right choice? And then going into anthropology with this idea of not necessarily going into academia, there's the whole thing of like, do you really need to do anthropology or do you need to go for a PhD or, yeah, are you ever going to make money with this? And so, yeah, just wanted to share my story. But my love and passion for anthropology definitely started kind of early, maybe without me knowing it. So I grew up in a household where my dad was a political science professor at Stetson University, where I grew up in the land. And my mom was born in Brazil and moved to the United States with my father when they got married during my dad's PhD research. And so grew up in a multicultural house and a house where we would go to Brazil over the summers to see the family and then kind of come back to the States, and had this kind of duality to separate life. I had my Brazilian life and my American life, and just as a young kid, didn't really comprehend that. Had some times in which I didn't necessarily like it, because I was like, oh, why do I have to go to Brazil while all my friends are hanging out or going to camp and stuff? But also loved it because all my family was in Brazil. All my cousins out there, aunts, uncles. My mom's one of a very large family, so it's a really happy experience when I go there, and don't have too much family here in the United States. And so that was just integrated into me, and I didn't really understand it because growing up in Central Florida, didn't really know any other Brazilians, but there was a huge Hispanic population. And I felt the connection, but didn't feel a connection because I didn't speak the same language at all. And just growing up, kind of feeling that duality, I guess, and having that experience in Brazil. Also went to school for a little bit in Brazil during one of my dad's sabbaticals. And that, yeah, just got the bug of like wanting to be in Brazil. And so to a certain point after a bit, it was like, how do I figure out how to have a life in Brazil and the United States? Brazil's so far away, so it's expensive to get out there. It's hard to get out there and like commit the right amount of time. And so after high school, when I graduated, I actually did a gap year and spent the year in Brazil. And it was very important for me. I had a little bit of difficulties in my first 2 years of high school, not doing well in school, and then kind of turned it around my second 2 years, but I wasn't sure where I wanted to go with life. So I did a gap year in Brazil, and spent some time, 3 months living with a mayor during re-election that was a friend of my dad's, which was brilliant. Spent some time with my family, worked at one of my uncle's bars. Then moved to the state of Bahia on the coast and worked at a like high-end rich person resort place and had the kind of like business side of that.
And yeah, what a different experience going from like a local bar to some place like that. Like I can imagine just from my experiences in Mexico, like we stayed 6 days at like a resort. And then our last day, like, I think we were flying out a different time from everyone else. So like, we just stayed in an Airbnb, like in Puerto Vallarta proper. And it was just like, wow, so different. Yeah. But continue. Sorry.
It's fascinating. That's cool. No, I love that. So yeah, definitely, you know, at my uncle's bar, I was serving caipirinhas and listening to like samba and a little hole in the wall place. And then at the resort in Troncoso, it's where like Bill Gates is regularly gone. It's not just like regular rich, it's like next level rich kind of thing. And so I was a waiter for one family at a time, and I stood in the corner, hand behind back, didn't look at them, but out of the corner of my eye, I had to have to like read all their needs. And so I was like, I don't feel this, I don't really like this. That's when I decided I don't want to follow the money path. I was like, I see these people here and, you know, they're experiencing something that's beautiful and amazing, but it seems kind of fake. They're speaking English, they're having all their needs met, and they're not going out and like seeing that. And if I committed my life to money, sure, I could travel, but I would have the resort travel experience. And I love being in small towns, committing 2 to 3 months with a family or this or that. So after that, I hitchhiked for a while, spent 2 months just hitchhiking around Brazil, and then volunteered at this reforestation NGO called Idecambi in the Atlantic rainforest. And there I met the owner of it, Robin, and he kind of just like opened my mind to a certain degree, where he talked about development work that he's doing, but he saw development work as like at its base a bad thing. And I was fascinated, like, but you do development work, how can it be a bad thing? And he's like, development work at its base is like a bad thing. It's not really resolving the problem at its root. So it takes a lot of research and insight into figuring out how to do development work in a way that's not just kind of like making you feel good about yourself, building a church without like, or building a school without like seeing if the community needs a school. So that's when I was like, okay, I want to do development work, but I want to figure out how to do it the right way. And so I went into anthropology and started that whole process, and started at Stetson, where my dad taught the first 2 years because it was free, did my kind of basic classes there, and then transferred to Syracuse because I read a book by John Burdick, who became my mentor, and I did my senior research class thesis with him, and kind of committed so much time and commitment to him. I just have to say, unfortunately, he passed away in 2019, and so
my sympathies.
You know, miss him, and but I hope to be able to honor him in a good way moving forward with the work that I do.
Yeah. What was that book that he wrote?
So The Color of Sound is his most famous book. It's an ethnography in which he kind of goes into a favela, or however you want to say that, but favela in São Paulo. And he looks at kind of religious rap and how it kind of the social capital gained through the community of religious rap compared to secular rap, or not necessarily compared to, but like he looks at that. And I was just fascinated by that. And I love music. It's not necessarily my like research path, but I just love the idea of this guy going into favelas, which are considered dangerous and scary, and kind of just that like stereotypical bad, don't go in there. And he went in there and wrote a beautiful story and created this like, true story, which I love that kind of style of anthropology in which you understood their struggles and the value of music. And like, it's not just something that you do for fun, but is life changing. And I understood that through his work, which was cool.
Yeah. I think something that, you know, in addition to music is, you know, dance and how important dance is in culture. And I am so thankful because I'm finishing out my last couple of quarters at UCSB and I'm super privileged that like all my ANTH stuff's done. So I'm kind of taking like what I want to take. Yeah. And I'm taking like a dance appreciation history class. And honestly, I can't imagine loving it more. First of all, the teacher's great. Her voice, she could record audiobooks. But second of all, just learning about how culture is tied in with dance and how a lot of these traditional lineage-based society dances really reaffirm cultural values and social roles sometimes. So it's really cool. You know, music obviously is included in that dance. So it's a fun thing to really investigate from like a historical anthropological lens because it really defines cultures. And something that I wanted to ask you about, your time is spent in Brazil, is what were some of the cultural differences when you'd go back to the United States? I can imagine spending so much time with family. There's a real like, you know, rather than just being like a tourist, you probably kind of adopted some cultural tendencies or just ideas that may have been kind of conflicting when you came back to the United States and were talking to your peers, maybe just even the way like interacting with family.
Yeah, 100%. That kind of, you know, plays into what I was talking about, the duality experience and kind of the outsider of both. When I'm in the United States, definitely less outsider here because I was raised here. I'm more connected to the cultural norms, like what people are talking about, the music we're listening to and stuff like that. But I definitely felt disconnected to a certain degree. But when I'd go to Brazil, you know, I would always, my Portuguese always has to kind of like build itself back up. So one, I'm the American that is going there with semi-broken Portuguese. That gets better pretty quickly, but you know, I'm not listening to the same music. I don't know. Everyone sits down in Brazil and they watch the favela that's like every day, Monday through Friday, and everyone's watching it. And I show up there and it's like, who's that? What's going on? What are they doing? But when I got to live there in Brazil for a year during my dad's sabbatical, when I was in sixth grade, I got to go to school there. And so that was fascinating because I got to kind of integrate more into it. I was in the educational system. I was able to watch a favela all the way through from beginning to end. And it's, you know, the stereotypical things that you always hear, people are so nice there. You kind of go and there's that value of just like happiness and less so. I find myself here like, what's your trajectory? What's your goal? What are you trying to achieve? And obviously there's still an aspect of that, but I feel like in Brazil, it's more, how are you going to be happy? Or how does this align with like being connected to your family? Or just less that like strong expectation of reaching a certain thing and more just being like happy and a good person and this and that. And like, yeah, being able to be around your family. And so that's obviously hard living in the United States. I don't get to be connected with that side of the family as much, but it's one of the big things I noticed between there and here is definitely family values, I guess.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I feel the same way. Like anytime I travel, just you notice like the little things and the little differences that make you appreciate things more. I know when I was in Japan, I was so overwhelmed by just how kind everyone was. Even though we spoke no Japanese, they were like, please let us show you everything in our beautiful country. And, you know, lots of times when you go into a foreign country and you don't speak the language, they're not as welcoming, and rightfully so. I mean, maybe not rightfully so, but I can understand that. But yeah, so I think travel just in general teaches us so much about how to be better humans in a way, like how to be more accepting humans.
Yeah.
Throughout all of your like hitchhiking and travels throughout Brazil, is there like one place in particular that's kind of stuck out to you that you've fallen in love with? Maybe it's the family homeland.
Yeah, so, you know, hard to boil it down into a single one. And even during my 2 months of 2 to 3 months of hitchhiking in Brazil, while it was movement and on the road and everything, if you look at the map of Brazil, the space that I was able to traverse is tiny compared to the rest of the country. But I was able to go between Bahia, Minas Gerais, São Paulo, and Rio that are kind of all centralized around there. And so Minas Gerais is the state where my family's from, and I do absolutely love it. It's kind of rural country. It's rolling hills and cow and sugarcane and these, you know, beautiful little, well, the towns themselves may not be beautiful, but you look around and like the scenery is beautiful. There's waterfalls. People are really nice. The food there is delicious. There's cheese. There's pão de queijo, which is this beautiful little doughy cheese ball thing from there. So obviously that has a place in my heart that I love, and it's where I want to go back to and try to do my research there and stuff. But the state of Bahia, which is on the coast, where I stayed for a while, that area is just gorgeous, and life there truly is next level. Like, there's a saying where it's basically like, I don't really care what's happening outside of Bahia. My life is good here, and like, that's all that matters. And so I was there while I was applying for college, and I was like, man, do I submit this application, or do I just live a life on the beach and stuff? And that is the little complication between the Brazilian and American culture there, but I'm glad I went to school and followed through with that.
Yeah. I was going to ask, I don't even need to keep this in the episode. It's more just for my own personal curiosity. Is it less common in Brazil for students like in our generation to go to university?
I think my generation, so, you know, my cousins, may have been the first generation of going to college. Okay. And so there was kind of a big wave. And it does kind of relay with access to resources. And so my cousins that are in São Paulo or are in some of the bigger cities, they did go to college, whilst my family that's still in the tiny town, São Miguel do Anta, haven't had the resources or as easy of an opportunity to get to it.
Yeah.
Brazil, there is an opportunity for like free college through the state and federal education system, but you have to pass a test, and the test requires so much studying for, and it's really hard to pass it. And so a lot of people pay for tutoring to prepare for it. And so
getting to a testing location can be
Having the time to study, because some of my cousins, when they're 16, they started working, or mothers by the time they're 18 or 19 or this or that. And so just kind of the life's obligations kind of make it harder. But I do think this generation is kind of it's expanded a lot, and that's partially because of like Brazil laws and programs making it easier for it to happen, and partially just more access to those resources.
I'm glad that we brought that up, just because it's just interesting. I mean, I just know so little about like the goings on in other countries, and I just feel, you know, good when I get to learn a little bit more. So, you know, a way that you've applied your anthropological experiences is through AmeriCorps and Peace Corps. And, you know, actually that's something that my mom really wanted to do. She really wanted to go to the Peace Corps. But actually I know very little about it other than the general concept. So first, let's maybe just start with like the basic goals of either one. I'm not really sure if they even like work together. Just kind of like the basic goals. And then we can talk about your experience, just because, so in case any of our listeners like aren't familiar with it.
Definitely. So, you know, both AmeriCorps and Peace Corps will probably not be super happy with me because I don't remember to the word our three goals and stuff. But
I don't think they're listening.
Peace Corps was made first. And the kind of goal of Peace Corps is to have an opportunity in which people from the United States are able to go to communities in different countries that are specifically asking to receive kind of like Peace Corps volunteers. So it's not like we're going and being like, we're coming. They have to go through a process in which they ask for it. And Peace Corps has changed over the years. In the past, it was more just direct help, like helping with the farms and providing resources and kind of the helping hand. Now it's more capacity building. And so the goal of Peace Corps is to have us in these communities and support different organizations in their capacity to provide the resources for the communities. And so for me, I did rural extension. And so I was working with the Department of Agriculture, and less so than like me showing up and being the agriculture expert, which I wasn't, my role was to show up and help teach the agriculture experts how to best convey that information to the communities they're working with, and how to do it in a way that will, be retained by the communities and also promote leadership within their own communities. So that is something that I think Peace Corps is pretty radical and progressive in the sense that it's not just like, let's show up with money and resources and build this thing. It's more so, let's show up. The first year is just you being with community, kind of doing ethnography to a sense. You're kind of, understanding the resources, connecting to the community, and doing capacity building activities with the community members, such as like, what are the resources available? What are the deficits that we have? How can we use these resources available to address these deficits? And how can we do it in a way in which like you're actively leading this process? And so, yeah, that's Peace Corps. Outside of that, they're also, the goal is to, teach that country or those people American culture and values and stuff. And then when we come back, teach Americans our host nation's culture and values and stuff like that. And then AmeriCorps was made later, I think by Bill Clinton. And AmeriCorps is basically like a domestic Peace Corps. And so AmeriCorps is also a really cool program that connects people with nonprofits that are looking for extra help for certain activities. And so it helps out the volunteer person going through AmeriCorps, because it gives them an opportunity to work with an organization in different capacities, whether you're volunteer coordinator. I did food coordinator for a food bank in Seattle. And then also gives that nonprofit the opportunity to have a person working for them, not on their own payroll. So they're able to hire one more person, which can help out a lot for these small nonprofit organizations. Yeah. And so they're both just really great opportunities to kind of go into this world of like development work or kind of nonprofit work, because the difficulty I found when I got out is I wanted to do this work. But when you leave college, you don't necessarily have work experience. Mm-hmm. And so you need to get that one way or another. And there's a lot of different, volunteer or internship opportunities, but a lot of these, especially if they're international, require for you to pay to get into it, or they don't pay you, so you have to have your own source of income during that time. That just wasn't possible for me. And so AmeriCorps served as a really awesome opportunity to do it domestically and kind of get introduced to that and really learn a lot. You get paid.
I was going to say, it's a federal minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I moved to Seattle, where I think minimum wage there was like $15 or something an hour. And I was getting paid like $8 an hour. And it was tough, and I had to work an extra job. And, I was on SNAP. I got food from the food bank I worked at. I worked with, I did side jobs like farm or gardening for people and stuff, but it was a great experience. And I learned so much and got connected to this community, and really, I'm so thankful that I worked with the community that I'm working with. If you're looking to do AmeriCorps, like, make sure that the nonprofit feels like it's something that you want to do, because I have a friend that did for like United Way or something, and she was just in a basement for like a year just doing postcards and like putting signs up on people's properties, and that she didn't learn anything. She didn't get any experience from that. So, you know, you're not getting paid a lot. So might as well not get paid a lot to do something that you feel great about.
And is there some agency in picking that nonprofit?
Yeah, it's like a weird like Craigslist thing for AmeriCorps ads or jobs. So you go and it's like, this is where I want, or this is kind of what I'm looking for. And it's just a long list. And I think you can apply up to like 5 or 10, and then you hear back from them and get connected and stuff. And which was really cool. Definitely, you know, everything's gray area, and so there's the benefits of it and there's the downsides of it, but my personal experience, I can't speak for everyone, it was hard, but with that difficulty I had some beautiful experiences, some tragic experiences, but I wouldn't have changed it for anything else.
Yeah, and it sounds like it really set you up with the skills and know-how to now work at a food bank. And as you were mentioning, like, it's not just the actual like distribution of food that you do. It's so much more. It's serving the community. It's helping people with, you know, resources. So let's first start with a direct lesson you took from that into the food bank. And then we can talk about like what your day-to-day looks like and how you assist people, you know, in Denver.
Yeah. So, you know, with what that makes me think, and I'm going to tie another question into a little bit, is kind of why or how does anthropology apply to any of this stuff? And anthropology has always, I asked my professor the same thing that John Burdick before I graduated, is like, how is this going to kind of apply to my jobs moving forward? And he's like, it's going to apply to everything moving forward. The interesting thing about anthropology is that it just changes your outlook on everything, how you communicate with people, how you perceive people, how you perceive your surroundings, history, everything. And so that obviously played into first AmeriCorps and then Peace Corps and then here, in the sense that my job is very person forward. I'm communicating with people, and I'm communicating with people from a variety of cultures, different backgrounds, different socioeconomic means, different languages, religious values, and everything. And so obviously I can't speak every language, and my anthropology training didn't teach me how to understand every single culture, but it taught me how to be conscious of it and how to be culturally relative. Yeah. And, you know, it also gave me the interest in that. And so it kind of helped me have this like, oh, I want to kind of dive into that difference, or like dive into these communities and really try to connect myself with them as much as possible. And I think each job has helped me connect with people better, because I'm connecting with people basically, and connecting them to resources and people in very difficult situations. And so it's helped me do that. And really now at the food bank here, my position is SNAP outreach representative with a focus on the rural communities in Colorado. And so I focus more on the northeastern section of Colorado and then going up into the Rocky Mountains a little bit. And these are very rural communities and very different communities between the mountains and the kind of more conservative Colorado plains. And I think I do a good job of just being able to connect with them. And it takes a lot to be able to ask for help. And I think in order to be able to ask for help, it helps a lot to have a person that you feel you can trust and connect with. And when you kind of stereotypically think of the like Department of Human Services person, you think of like name, yes, okay, last name, there, where are you from? Nope, that's not what I'm at. Like the kind of just cutthroat, just asking your questions and stuff. And I try to take it on me to like get to know the person while I'm doing it to a certain degree. You know, I'm not asking about their pet's name if they're not trying to share that with me, but I try to not add some flourish to it. And if they're willing to share information with me, I'll talk with them. And I've noticed myself, I'm a, you know, signing people up for SNAP or food stamps, but I've seen these people at the mobile pantries that I go to every month for the past year and a half. And now they're telling me about their son that's coming to visit, or how their dog passed away, or they're changing medication and this and that. And if, yeah, I'm just a snap outreach person. I don't need to do that. But I think anthropology and the past work with AmeriCorps, Peace Corps, and this has helped me get that empathy and like desire for connection.
Yeah. You're an approachable trust, you know, person that they've instilled their trust in. And I think that's so special. But I also think that your dedication to making it a, hopefully, you know, smooth process for them, making it a compassionate process for them. Because lots of times, I mean, even if it comes to like, I'll speak from my own experience, like trying to get disability services, like there's a lot going through, simply going through the hoops to get the resources you need can be very taxing, can be very challenging, discouraging even. So having someone who's going to come in and really like make that easier for you is great. And, you know, I wonder, like, is that part of where like the wearing color for shirts came in, like wanting to just be this person they could immediately see and be like, this person is fun and brings some joy and some personality connection to this quote unquote mundane job. It's not mundane, but that's how people may view it.
Yeah. And this is something that people probably have different opinions on. And I think I probably have a strong opinion on this that many other people maybe don't share, but I think that certain things can make experiences so much more enjoyable. And sometimes those little changes are so easy to do when like, so calling a person and rather than being, hello, my name is Russell with Food Bank of the Rockies, I call them like, hi there, my name's Russell. I'm a SNAP Outreach representative and I'm calling because this and that, and just really want to make sure that like, if there's anything you need. And so just that change in voice, that change in attitude, adding like, oh, have a great rest of your day. You know, just changes can literally be like a light in a person's day that changes them. But also, so the colorful shirts, just showing up in a room and being fun and having like a positive attitude can change a boring situation, such as signing up for SNAP, into just a little nicer, a little more enjoyable. Yeah. And so, yeah, with SNAP and this work, it's great. It's easy. I don't work for the government, so I'm like private, more able to dress different. But for AmeriCorps and Peace Corps now, I did have to kind of adhere to these more government rules. And so for Peace Corps, and I understand it, and I don't know if I necessarily agree with it or not, but I understand the reasoning behind it. But when I went to Guatemala, they told me that I had to cut my hair short to be more like culturally acceptable to their norms of what is male expectations and female expectations. And by having my hair long, the idea was that it may make it harder for me to connect with the community and kind of this and that. I understand that and I followed the rules and stuff, but I also think sometimes being yourself can also help people connect with you. Yeah. And that this is my way of being myself. And
Oh, you know what I was gonna say is that too, with the hair thing, it's like, well, what about, and I'm not saying this to assume anything about your gender identity or sexuality, but just saying like, well, what if there's a kid in Guatemala who, or an adult in Guatemala who's wanting to experiment in outside of the typical norms, wanting to see someone who maybe it has a bit more of an American flair, which may just be long hair, because obviously in America, like plenty of people have long hair. It says nothing about necessarily your identity. But someone may be wanting to explore something new in a way to express themselves differently. So sometimes just having those like little examples can be cool. I was just giving a talk at my old middle school and I was like trying to explain biological sex and gender and how they're different. And I am like on a mission to figure out how to explain to children under age 10, like how biological sex and gender are different. I haven't figured it out yet, but now I'm on a mission to like, so I can represent alternate out of the binary for kids that need that, like to feel like they're not alone.
Yeah, that's really quite the complication, right? Is figuring out how to share this information in a way that's culturally appropriate. And you don't really think of like United States being culturally conservative on things of, or at least in the past, culturally conservative on things of like sex and gender, except especially recently now with the whole idea of like what's being taught in schools and mm-hmm. control over what children are exposed to. It's kind of, that's the situation here. But when we were doing work in Guatemala, it was definitely kind of something that we had to be very cautious of. And so I was part of the project advisory committee in which a few people worked with like more state level, like representatives of the Ministry of Agriculture. So we kind of planned how to best work with the Peace Corps' goals and the Department of Agriculture for Guatemala's goals to work together. And there are certain things on like, you know, we bring up topics such as like gender expression or sexuality and kind of the experience of women in the workforce, because mm-hmm. it's still a very macho culture. And so female volunteers have just in general a much more difficult experience in mm-hmm. Peace Corps Guatemala and probably other places, because they have that like, that sexualized identity mm-hmm. by their coworkers. So we were trying to kind of work with them on figuring out how to talk about gender and sexuality in a way that was culturally appropriate. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about, in a very Catholic country, about sexuality mm-hmm. or, you
very
know,
tough.
Gender expression while trying to maintain this kind of, you know, ability to work with each other, mm-hmm. professionalism. That was a very tight line to walk, mm-hmm. but one that I think needs to be pushed.
I was going to say, so but an important of, like, line to walk.
Accepting cultural differences while also, pushing mm-hmm. it slightly. And by like me showing up with long hair and acting different or having inflections in my voice, that people usually assume makes me gay, a person saying that may have made it easier for them to represent themselves, their true selves, whether they're mm-hmm. gay or not, just to feel that. And by me hiding that aspect of myself, I didn't help push that boundary to where it could have made it easier for someone else to mm-hmm. be themselves. And so I definitely think pushing boundaries for your form of expression, one, like, is fun and exciting, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but also helps other people be able to push those boundaries or not have to push a boundary to be able to express themselves.
Yeah. And like you said, I think it's an important line to walk and an important conversation to have, whether it means, you know, obviously there are some rules like, you know, like cutting your hair that like have to be followed or whatever, but at least trying to have some dialogue around it and perhaps like come up with alternatives and or like ways that in the future, maybe 5 years down the road, like we can continue to push for a little bit more expression. I just hit my microphone, so I'm sorry if there was a really loud noise. But back to the food bank stuff, I know something you really wanted to touch on was SNAP, you know, people's like who can be eligible, your experience having it throughout college. So I'm going to give you the floor for that. I should say I currently utilize the EBT SNAP within California. I have every intention to apply again, like when I go to grad school. I'm going to find out in 2 weeks where that is.
I'm with you there. I'm waiting to hear back from grad school.
So scary.
But yeah, so SNAP, I'm a big SNAP advocate. And for those that don't know what SNAP is a federal food assistance program where if you apply for it and you're qualified, they'll send you an EBT card to your house and put between $20 to $250 on that card a month. And then you can take that card to the grocery store or like convenience store or even farmers markets, and you can buy your groceries with that. It takes the money out of the federal government rather than your own personal bank account. So it's a huge help and can really free up space to pay for rent or other expenses. And with my work, I work with a bunch of different populations that I've been kind of trying to dive into. One of the populations that I've been working with is the parole and correctional facility population, and then also college students. And so within the college student community, there is a huge need for food assistance, but there is also a huge stigma against food assistance. And in the past, it has changed during this past year, but it was really confusing to apply for SNAP as a college student. You had to qualify for work study and show that you were working a certain amount of hours, so on and so forth. But now it's been made a lot easier. And so just want to make a shout out if anyone is interested in applying for SNAP, or just like, yeah, feel like you could just use that extra little help. It's a great program. I definitely advise contacting the Department of Human Services or a food bank in your area. Maybe they can connect you with that. But it's not just for like the idea that people think, like a single mother or a person that's homeless or a person that is not, you know, it's also for college kids. It's to help you during periods of transition or periods of need. And you know, college is a period of transition. And also you can really help out your community through it. I love to find little ways of activism. And so if you use SNAP, it helps support, like for every dollar spent on SNAP, I think it's like $1.64 back into the local community. It's been shown as one of the best ways to support a local economy. But also there's the Double Up program, and it's maybe named different in different places or states, but if you go to a farmer's market and you spend your SNAP there, you get $2 of spending money for every dollar of SNAP that you spend. So one, you get access to fresh vegetables and produce and stuff like that, but two, and you're getting double the amount, but two, you're supporting a local farmer, and that is a pretty radical, cool, like, act of, you know, communal support. And so if you're able to have money from the federal government injected into small local farmers, that's pretty radical in my mind and a pretty cool thing to do.
It is.
And you also get great produce and food.
So. Yeah. So I did not know, after this is my third year of being on SNAP, that you could use it at farmers markets. So I learned something today and I'm super excited. I'm definitely going to go do that. And then also, you know, just a little thing, if there are any UCSB students that are listening, UCSB has a food bank that's located in the university center. You can get food. I'm pretty sure they're open 5 days a week. The UCSB Miramar food pantry is over by Sierra Madre, and they have food Monday, Tuesday, Thursday from 4 to 8 for anyone that's a student, including grad students. So that's my little disclaimer for UCSB people. I frequent both of those. And my favorite thing is I get the canned chicken because my dog is a princess and will not eat her food unless I put something on top of it. So my favorite thing is to get the canned chicken for her because it's pretty easy. But yeah, I'm really appreciative of you just like outlining that for people because I think it's so important. And you're right, like so few people know about it and know how many people are eligible for it.
Yeah. And it's not a thing to be ashamed of at all. And honestly, some of the best communities that I've been a part of, and it's kind of what I do with the work that I do, but have been the volunteers for different food banks and stuff. So if you're even interested, you know, volunteer for the food bank, help them out a little bit. And then you also get to go through the line. You'll meet some amazing people and just have some great conversations and be doing a good thing for the community. So
yeah,
worth it to check out. And
definitely.
Yeah, I think we also said we'd be putting a link maybe to like a national connection for applying for SNAP or food stamps.
We will have some links in the description of the episode, just so everyone knows, like there's always links in the description of the episode, whether it's more information on the guest, something they mentioned, and always we have our partner, the American Anthropological Association, linked because they actually not sponsor because it's not financial, but support a lot of anthropology podcasts, which I think is really great. You know, they were super welcoming to me and just promoting, you know, people that are in the field, spreading knowledge. It's really awesome. One of the things that I wanted to touch on, and one of my favorite things about the podcast that we get to do, is talk about, you know, people's lives that are outside of the awesome work we do. And one of the things that you're super active in is music. You're in a band, you produce your own music. Tell me about that. Like, how does it make you feel? Like, does it feel like the coolest thing on earth to have like a song on Spotify? Like, I know the second I saw my podcast on like Spotify and Apple Podcasts, I was like, wow, I've made it.
Yeah. So definitely love music. It's been kind of one of the cornerstones of my life since the beginning, is the connection with my dad. My dad's a musician. And through high school, I was in a couple bands with friends. We'd organize little concerts, music events, had a festival out of my house for like 5 years. And then yeah, I was able to play some music with some friends. It's, for me, I was never raised religious and don't have that connection that I know is so valuable for many people, but never had that connection in terms of something that made me feel kind of like out of body or a connection to something else. And music for me is that. Sometimes when I'm playing music with my best friend Ian or my dad, and like we just connect and we know it, there's a moment where I'm just nirvana sort of. Mm-hmm. And so that is so important for me. And it's also listening to music, and the music community. Every time I've moved, the music community has been my kind of staple for how I connect with the community. And they're all oftentimes, you know, promoting small bands, promoting local venues that are owned by families. And it's a very communal sensation that I love. Being a person that moves around a lot, I've always been a drummer, grew up a drummer. And so after a certain point of moving basically every other year, I realized that it is hard to move with a drum set and having a little drum box won't cut it. So after a certain point, I started learning guitar and trying to write my own music and stuff. And that filled that gap to where I could then just sit in my room, play guitar, and have something beautiful come out rather than just like tapping sounds. And then when I was in Peace Corps in Guatemala, I went there with some like recording equipment. And one of my ways of self-care was just writing and recording. And during my time there, I recorded and wrote a couple little like albums or whatever you'll call it. It's just bedroom recordings and it's not the best, but it was my form of self-expression and it's comfort. And so I'm not on Spotify. Not there yet, but it's, yeah, something, and it's one of the things, so the music community is one of the things that I look most forward to having a place in which I connect with for a long time. Since I've been 18, I haven't lived in a place longer than 2 years. And so for my PhD, it's gonna be the first place that I live longer than 2 years. And it's one of the things that I'm most excited for is to be able to get engaged with the music community, be in a place long enough to have that. And yeah, I'm stoked for it.
So I guess, you know, that's actually a pretty natural transition. You're applying to PhD programs. What is it that you want to ask, you know, questions of in your research? I know you said you'd like to go back to Brazil and do some of your field work there, but what types of questions do you want to ask?
Yeah. So I will say that I feel like that has been my strongest point in my applications for myself, is that, you know, I don't have a master's degree, so I don't have the research experience from that. My hope is that my experience working in the nonprofit sector kind of replaces that. But I had an idea for a research project and the connections to it that really by what I've heard from some folks, just kind of sounded very strong and like a possible research project. So for me, the recommendation that I could have in this point of still being not accepted necessarily yet but is to have a strong research project in which like mm-hmm. you have the connection to a place or yeah. these names or an idea. You don't have to have the whole theory, but I have a location and the people, like a nonprofit that I'm trying to work with.
Yeah.
And that makes it a lot easier. But so yeah, my research is I want to go back to the region of Minas Gerais where my family's from and kind of be involved with the nonprofit reforestation NGO that I had been with in the past called Itacambi. Mm-hmm. And in Brazil, in this region, it's a very prominent region for bauxite mining, which is a form of mining where they strip the topsoil and then they excavate all the minerals that they're getting for, and then they replace the topsoil on top of all the mixed up kind of like deeper soil. And so in Brazil, and I think it's like this a lot of places, but you only own the like topsoil and you don't own the like deep earth beneath it. And so international mining corporations and national mining corporations are able to effectively, buy the land from the government. And I don't know if this is completely right, but get the rights to be able to go to a land and then ask a person to leave the land while they do the excavation, and they rent it, they give the person a certain amount of money, but there is no way to say no because you don't own the rights. So you can say no and not get the money, you'll still get kicked off. Mm-hmm. But when they, do the excavation and put the topsoil back on there and the farmer returns to the land, the fertility of the soil is completely destroyed. So then their form of income is destroyed. And so it kind of creates this migration from the rural, it's one form of creating this migration of rural to urban towns where mm-hmm. kind of cycles of poverty continue there. So my interest is kind of looking at the situation in which these, relatively poor rural farmers, how they're able to contend with the power of this multinational mining corporation with like room full of lawyers and all the mm-hmm. resources behind that and the education and just the inherent power difference between those two, how the farmers are able to contend with that, but also how the farmers work with a local anti-mining coalition kind of led by this reforestation NGO Itacambi, how they're able to kind of fight that through this like coalition with the farmers and the anti-mining coalition, but also kind of like understand certain points of friction between how farmers understand the value of the land and how this reforestation NGO that's more conservation understands the value of the land. So how do they work together, but also at what points are there conflict, and maybe like, just that general understanding. And then from there, that's where I have to understand more of the theory, like mm-hmm. what specifically am I going to look into and stuff. But that's the kind of skeletal structure of what I want to look into.
That's so awesome. I'm so excited to hear where your research goes because it's just so fascinating, and having like that deep connection to the place that, it's going on, you'll really be able to just further understand your own family. It's so cool. I love when people have mm-hmm. personal connections to their research. It really makes the research significant on a different level. And, you'll be able to involve the community. You'll be able to, just be an incredible anthropologist. Yay.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I'm so excited for it. And it really is, when I was looking into why I want to do a PhD, and, I want to do it because a lot of stuff I want to do, I think this will help for it. And also I love research and kind of, intergenerational thing between my father having had his PhD and stuff. I kind of want it now. Mm-hmm. But also it's a beautiful connection in my mind for me to be able to connect with Brazil. And as I said earlier, I was always trying to figure out how to do that like Brazil US thing. Mm-hmm. And working with the food bank here, I had my 2 weeks vacation that I saved up and I went to Brazil for 2 weeks. And 2 weeks was so short. My family lives in so many different places. It's so expensive to get out there. It's like a day and a half travel just to get there. And so that's 3 or 4 days out of that, and once a year to do that. And so I had this like, oh my God, how I can't do this forever. I already know I was gonna be applying for PhD, but so this gives me an opportunity to like live there for my research and connect with there and like, deep dive into the history and the culture and really make this part of me that has been part of me, but not fully realized, and try to fully realize that to the best that I can. And yeah, I'm excited for how it'll turn out. There's obviously going to be some complications. Studying your home culture isn't, you know, there are complications with that. I know some of my family is directly involved with the mining, and like they're supporters of having this, and other family members are kind of interested in conservation. And so how is my research going to affect my relation with my family, and or how is my relation with my family going to affect my research?
Wow, that's deep.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. The last thing that I just want to say, because we love dogs on this podcast, is you have a dachshund. What's the dachshund's name?
Yeah, so I have a little dachshund named Alfredo. He has an Instagram as the Saucy Sausage. I think it's like the underscore Saucy Sausage. Right. Super cute. Love him so much. He's our pandemic puppy, and he's really smart. He loves the snow. And so during the snow days, like it is here, he just burrows his face through the snow and runs through it. And he sleeps in, like, he's just our child. He sleeps in bed with us. Like, he eats better food than us most time. Like, our lives have changed to not revolve around him, but to include him as much as we can, which is
good.
And a very snow. Yeah, he loves the snow.
Yeah. I was so worried about taking Daisy to the snow just because she's stubborn. And I was like, she's either going to love it or she's going to look at it and be like, I'm not going outside. And she loved it. It was the best thing ever. The cutest thing to see. Because Daisy's like a very mellow dog. So seeing her like run in the snow was just like.
She gets the zoomies.
She never has. She has those zoomies like every once in a while. And when she does it, I just like fall over laughing because it's so cute. She's such an interesting dog. She's an interesting one.
Yeah, it's been great, and helps out with a lot with the pandemic, because we were people, my partner, she was working for a kind of like domestic violence hotline. And so she was working from home a lot and dealing with very heavy situations and by herself. And so having the dog there helped her out so much, and also gets us out of the house and, you know, forces you on those little walks when it's dark and like cold and you really don't want to, but then when you're out there, you're like, okay, this is good for me.
Yeah, for sure. I broke my foot pretty early on in the pandemic, and I just like, I'm lucky my mom lives close enough that she just came and took Daisy for a couple days, so I could really those first couple days like not have to walk. And it was day three and I was like, oh my God, I haven't been outside in 3 days. And I was like, what? This is like, people don't understand how much the dog helps you with your daily routine until the dog's not there. And I was like, oh no. But it was good because my foot needed to heal. Because I broke both feet during the pandemic. Like one, and then like a couple months later, the next one. So when the second one happened, I like took all the lessons that I learned from the first one, which was walking Daisy on it for like 3 weeks and like making it way worse. I was like, okay, this time we're going to take a couple days, like actually sit down and let the foot heal. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I'm so appreciative. It was so great to meet you and to hear your story. Thanks for sharing with everyone.
Oh my God, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. And I look forward to you hearing back from what you've applied to and seeing all the great things that you do with this podcast and your career in the future. And
thank you.
Glad to be here.